Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit. Bandwidth for the Tech Guy is provided by CacheFly. CacheFly.com. Hi, this is Leo Laporte, and this is my Tech Guy podcast. This show originally aired on the Premier Network on Sunday, May 20th, 2018. This is episode 1490. Enjoy. The Tech Guy podcast is brought to you by Rocket Mortgage from Quicken Loans. Home plays a big role in your life. That's why Quicken Loans created Rocket Mortgage. It lets you apply simply and understand the entire mortgage process fully so you can be confident you're getting the right mortgage for you. Get started at rocketmortgage.com/techguy. Well, hey, how are you today? Leo Laporte here, the Tech Guy. Oh, it's time. Yeah, let's talk computers, the internet, home theater, digital photography. We can talk about smartphones, smart watches, you know, anything with a chip in it. Anything that, you know, is technology that's changing this world of ours. It's so many ways, so many interesting, fascinating, and sometimes scary ways. Robots. Phone number is 8888-ASK-LEO if you'd like to call in and ask a question, make a comment, make a suggestion, talk about robots. 888-827-5536. Toll free from anywhere in the U.S. or Canada. Outside that area, you could still reach us. Just use Skype or something like that to call. Should be toll free. Shouldn't cost you anything because it's a toll free number in the U.S. and Canada. We also have a great website. When you hear something on the show and you say, oh, I want to write that down. No, don't. You're driving. You can't do that. Just remember this, techguylabs.com. No charge, no sign up, just a website, techguylabs.com. I've been reading a lot because, you know, we run a website and I have a business. And some of our listeners and, you know, consumers are in the European Union. So I've been reading a lot about this new GDPR that goes into effect on Friday, the General Data Protection Regulation. And it's one of those things that happens as a you see this all the time, where a government, or in this case, the combined governments of the European Union, will promulgate a rule, a regulation. And then everybody ignores it. They had a privacy regulation, and everybody ignored it. It was sure, because it didn't have any teeth. So they said, well, let's give it some teeth, and they did. The maximum fine is the higher of 20 million euros, or 4% of your global revenue. So for a big company, that'd be a ton of money, and it's part of. So anyway, it goes into effect on Friday. You probably already are getting emails and messages from companies like Google and Facebook and Twitter saying, hey, we're changing our privacy policies. That's one thing you'll see right away. People's privacy policies will change. They may change some of the ways they handle your data, which is a good thing. Companies have 72 hours, for instance, to notify you if there's been a breach and your data has leaked out. That's great. I like that. They have to give you the right to any. First of all, they have to tell you what personal data of yours they collect, and then give you the right to have it deleted. At first, Facebook, we thought maybe would just make this available to members of the EU, people who live in Europe. But no, they're making it available worldwide. Maybe you've seen it. You can download all the data that Facebook has about you, and you can request that they delete it. Couldn't you? Didn't you used to be able to do that before? So that's all good. There is kind of this terrified hysteria about you know, oh my goodness, what's going to happen? And I think cooler heads are saying if you run a business as I do, are saying it's not time to panic. You'll get a warning, and you'll have a chance to comply, and you know it's not going to be the end of the world. Because you know if you have a website, for instance, you do collect information about people. You collect their internet address at the very least every time they visit you, and you might collect more. So you have to think about that and how you can delete it. Or maybe, and this might be the beneficial outcome of this, just collect less. By default, websites collect all this information. just because it's built in, but you can turn it off, and maybe people will start collecting less. That's not a bad thing. That's a good thing. This is all part of something that's going on in the last few years that's kind of interesting. If you're going to see it tonight on 60 Minutes, they're doing a big investigative piece on the power of Google. In fact, Google's stock went down Friday when people thought, this could be bad. This could be bad. But it's not, it's just that people are starting to pay attention to the kinds of information companies like Facebook and Google are gathering about us. They're kind of saying maybe there ought to be some controls on them. Should Google be accountable? Mostly, I think people want to know, what is it you're collecting and what are you doing with it? And that's, I think it's fair for Google to get some attention. 60 Minutes interviews a bunch of critics of Google. You know, if you're successful, there's going to be critics. a bunch of critics of Google, some of whom say they're, you know, it stifles competition. They interview the woman who is in charge of GDPR, Margarita Vestager. She's in the EC, the EU Competition Commissioner. Google was fined by her and the EU $2.7 billion last year and probably faces more investigation, as does Facebook. Mark Zuckerberg is scheduled to testify before them. And it's important. Companies aren't going to turn off the spigot to Europe. So they need to figure it out. If you operate in a country, you got to follow the laws of the country. Your only choice is to not to flout the law, but just not to be in that country. So some people are saying Apple should do. You know, Apple loves the Chinese market. It's the only way they can grow the iPhone sales because they've saturated the market in the West. But in India and China, where there are many, many consumers who don't yet have iPhones, can't afford iPhones yet, this is a big opportunity for Apple. But the Chinese government keeps asking Apple to do things that, I don't know, make me a little bit queasy. For instance, they're now pulling all the apps. First, they pulled last year all the apps that supported virtual private networks because people in China could use them to surf the net without being surveilled by the Chinese government. Now they're cracking down on something, on applications that have something built in called Call Kit. They can't offer it in China because it's encrypted. It allows Chinese citizens to make private phone calls. And Apple has decided, you know, Google, when Google was kind of faced with this, they just pulled out of China. They said, all right, well, we don't have to do business there. Apple really wants to be in China, and so they're complying with Chinese laws. And it's a slippery slope, isn't it? Apple, you know, says they fight hard for our privacy in the U.S., but when it comes to China, not so much. And it's only a matter of time before the Chinese government comes to Apple, as they did to Yahoo, and said, they went to Yahoo and they said, we want the names and addresses of these dissidents. They're using Yahoo Mail. And Yahoo handed it over, and those dissidents went to jail. How long before Apple's asked to do something like that? And then what will they do? You see, tech is a complicated thing. There's lots to talk about. And there's also, why won't my computer print? Things like that. And we'll talk anything you want to talk about in any of those areas. 8888 Ask Leo is my number, and I would love to hear from you. 888-827-5536. Kim Schaffer is there, ready to take your calls, ready to answer your calls. Leo Laporte, the tech guy, 8888 Ask Leo. Kim Schaffer's here. She's working hard like an octopus with eight arms answering the phones, going, hello, hello, hello. So we're going to get you on the air here. Give us a ring. Let's talk tech next. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Time to talk tech. 8888 Ask Leo. Are you feeling all right?
I'm feeling Kim all Schaffer. Right. I'm liking that.
Yeah.
Yeah. Michael always does such a great job.
Great music. Great music. Kim Schaffer is answering the phones. It's a team effort here.
Yeah.
It's a small team.
It's
a tiny team, but it's a team.
Four, five, maybe.
It's a couple of people.
But
a lot of calls, and I want to answer them in a proper order. So I ask you, Kim Schaffer, who should I start with?
Yeah, how about Rick in Poinciana, Florida?
All right.
Yeah. I think he's got an antiquated TV and wants to know if one of these newfangled devices can somehow...
Antiquated.
Yeah, you know, might be able to duct tape things together.
Hi, Rick. How antiquated is your TV?
Actually, what it is, Leo, is I'm going up to the north and I'm staying at a hotel that's almost like a hostel, but it's not a hostel. And the TV they have in there is just an old flat screen that's hooked up to the antenna on top of the building. What I want to do is I want to take my Amazon Fire Stick with me and figure out how I can plug it into this TV and then fire up Sling television and be able to watch all my cable channels.
Wouldn't that be nice?
Yeah, but I don't know how to do that, if that's even possible.
So, yeah, because your Fire Stick is HDMI, and I'm guessing you're saying that TV doesn't have an HDMI port.
No, it doesn't have HDMI in it. is there a workaround for that?
Well, yeah, not really. I mean, I guess. You can buy, for a couple $100, a HDMI to analog converter. Does a TV have...
It has the old RCA plugs, just, the old red, white, and yellow.
Just red, white, and yellow. That's called composite.
Yeah.
There's also component, which is yellow, green, and blue. If it doesn't have those, it only has analog. Yeah, I mean, you can go to monoprice.com. I haven't priced them out lately and find an HDMI to composite converter. Let's see. And then the other issue is getting that Fire Stick online.
Oh, the room has fantastic. The hotel has fantastic high speed internet, so that's not an issue.
Yeah, but you have to now. See, this is sometimes a problem in hotels because they do something called a captive portal. You know, where you when you first sign on to it, you don't just sign on to it. You get a page and you have to give them some information, that kind of thing.
Well, I actually just read about that online. They said that Fire Amazon has taking care of that, and that now
it'll work with the captive portal. All right.
Yeah. Okay. Fire Sticks now work with the
captive portal. Okay, portal. Good. The one other issue. So I'm looking on Amazon, and here's a HDMI to composite RCA out for, actually, it's not expensive, $37. The one other issue, and I just don't know what you're going to hit with this, is copy protection. So HDMI, which is a digital signal,
right,
has something built in called HDCP, which I'm going to guess stands for high def copy protection, although who knows. And what that will do is, if it's enabled, and many people require it, Netflix, Amazon may well require that everything along the chain, which would be the Fire TV, the TV itself, anything that's in between the two, a box of any kind, will support HDCP. So that to keep you from stealing their precious, precious video. And that might get in your way. So before you go out to your hotel, I would try, you know, the box at least isn't too bad. It's $37 on Amazon. I would try it at home and make sure that it doesn't block you. What may happen is you don't get a signal, or you'll get a downgraded signal because of copy protection.
Right.
High bandwidth digital content protection. Okay. HDCP. Thank you, Mike B. High bandwidth digital content protection. That's going to be your bugaboo. As always, copy protection gets in the way.
Okay.
All right.
Otherwise, I should be okay. If I don't get that copy problem,
yeah,
I should be good to go.
Yeah, this box will work. It'll convert it. Now, of course, the other way to go for people who don't yet have a Fire Stick is Roku still sells older Rokus that have composite out. So you can, there are still, you know, these digital interfaces that'll let you do it with composite out. They may have the copy protection issue. I don't know. Yeah, it's my guess. You know, if you, it's my guess you're not going to be able to do it just because of so I would buy this box and try it at home first, but my guess is it's going to put up a thing that says HDCP isn't going to let you play this. Be my guess, but I don't know. I should probably buy one of these and try it. So I'll put a link for the box in the, I found one on Amazon. All you have to do, it's easy enough to find, is Google. What you want is HDMI to composite converter. And once you Google that, and it may merely be that what will happen, this is why you have to try it. One of the options for HDCP is not to block it entirely, but to down-res it to make it lower quality, kind of I Love Lucy quality. And if you can live with that, at least you can still watch your Sling TV. Anybody who's done this, let me know. If you've got a suggestion, something that can help Rick out, let's hear about it. 8888 Ask Leo. Line 1, Bob in Burbank, California. Hi, Bob. Leo Laporte, the tech guy.
Hey, Leo. I listened to a bunch of your podcasts, and I got me hooked now on the IoT devices. And so I've got my sprinklers, I've got my thermostat, and I got a couple of outlets and some switches. So not too much, but every single one of them has their own app.
Right. Isn't that frustrating? Yeah. Ugh.
It is.
This home automation thing is really a Tower of Babel. It's not getting any better.
If I get a hub, will that help my situation?
In some cases, yes. Some cases, no. So most of the time, no. Most of the time, I know what you would like, which is a hub that has one app that lets you control everything else. SmartThings makes one. There are several of these that are designed to do that. But I asked our IoT expert, Stacey Higginbotham, who does the IoT podcast. Maybe you've heard that one. I asked her about this because she does this stuff all the time. And she said, no, you still have to have the apps. So let's say you have Hue lights. You can get a hub, like a SmartThings hub, that will talk to the Hue hub, but you still have to have the Hue hub. And you can do, in some limited ways, control the Hue lights. But if you want the full capability of the Hue lights and all the tones and the programs and all that, you need their app. So I guess it simplifies it a little bit for some of this. You know, a garage door opener is either open or closed. I would imagine it would work fully. It's just the stuff that's more sophisticated, perhaps.
Gotcha.
So there are a number of hubs. There's the SmartThings one is from Samsung. What you want is something that's going to handle the two major protocols, Zigbee and Z-Wave.
Z-Wave, right.
Yeah, depending on what devices you have. You may only have Zigbees or only have Z-Waves. And there's a couple of others. I want to say Wowie or what. There's another. I can't remember the name of it.
That's a Chinese company, right?
Yeah.
Or no.
That you're thinking Huawei. whoa. No, not that one. I'll find it for you. I'll put it up in the show notes. And I'm sure somebody will call. What do you do to make it easy? Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Who's the next in line? Leo Laporte, the tech guy, 8888, Ask Leo. Wink, that was the hub I was trying to remember, the Wink hub. That seems to be the most capable. The SmartThings hub or the Wink hub both speak all the relevant protocols and will give you at least some combined functionality in your wired home. It's still kind of a mess. I thought by now we'd have this all solved. But the problem is this is always going to be the problem. It's not in any one company's interest to make it, you know, work for everybody. Everybody wants to own their little piece of the pie. You know, Apple wants you to use all Apple stuff, and Google wants you to do all Google stuff. It's not good for consumers. It's good for the company. But as long as companies maximize profits and not consumer happiness, that's what you're going to get. You'd think they'd be aligned somewhat, but maybe not. they're what the computer scientists call orthogonal. One goes one way, the other goes the other. They're not quite aligned. Tom in St. Louis, Missouri. Hello, Tom. Leo Laporte, the tech guy.
Good morning, Leo.
Good morning.
I had a recent situation where my wife's phone died. I actually had to send it into the manufacturer to get a replacement. And because we use LastPass and two-factor authentication, the Google Authenticator obviously was not installed, and so we had a problem with that. Then I saw, I think it was Jason and Padre talking about this type of situation, and they said, oh, we don't use Google Authenticator, we use Authy. And so I'd like you to talk about Google Authy versus Google Authenticator, and one why one is better than the other.
Yeah. So, well, you just found out why one's better than the other. So let me explain a little bit what authenticators do. Good on you. You're doing the right thing. You're using LastPass, a password, which I should mention is a sponsor, but any password vault is a better solution because they encourage you to make a separate password for every site and to make that password long and strong, which means unmemorable. So a password vault keeps track of it for you. That way you can have good passwords instead of relying on, you know, your daughter's birth date and your dog's first name. So, that's all good. And then you make it even better when you turn on two-factor authentication. I'm always telling people to do that. It adds a little bit of complexity and trouble, but it sure makes it hard for hackers to get into your account. And most services now offer two-factor. Google, Twitter, Facebook, your bank. All of them will say, all right, here's your, you know, you got your password, log into your bank, and now we're going to either send you a 6-digit code. That way it'll be based, you know, you'll have to have your phone. That's a less good way to do it because people can steal your phone number. It's not unheard of. It's not hard, in fact. Just a little social engineering with your phone company, and they can get a SIM and have that two-factor sent to them instead of you. So that's why we regularly recommend authenticator programs. They would have to have physical possession of your phone. Now, the Google Authenticator, it works the same way. All of these authenticators work the same way. Microsoft has one. LastPass has one. And then there's the one I use and recommend, and so do all the people on my network because they're copying me. It's called Authy. They all work the same way. They take a secret number, which is kind of like the password. It's created by the site, the bank, the Google, Twitter, whatever. A long secret number that's yours and yours alone. And then they do something interesting. They combine it with the time of day using a technique we call hashing. They make a hash that creates a 6-digit number that changes every 30 seconds. So it's a one-time password. It's only good for 30 seconds. So even if somebody got it, they'd have to get into your account within 30 seconds because it's no good after that. As you probably noticed, if you don't use it right away, it doesn't work anymore. And if you use an authenticator, you'll see every 30 seconds that 6-digit number will change. So that's really good. What that's telling, let's say we're talking about Google. What that's telling Google is, all right, you know, this is good. Tom has not only the password, but we must have given him that secret number, and he must have an authenticator device because he's got the correct 6-digit code based on the time of the day and that number. So that's a good second factor, is a good way to do it, because even if a bad guy can steal or guess your password, he's unlikely to be able to steal or guess that secret code. But here's the problem. You know, when you first set up Google Authenticator or any authenticator, you're either entering in this 16-digit code or, more likely, you're using the QR code. Google will put up a little code on the screen you take a picture of with your phone, and it automatically populates that long number, so you don't have to type it in. But that's what's coming across in that QR code. So there are ways that you can, you know, if what happened to your wife happens to you, well, now you have to go back and reset the secret number with all of these places, and you can recreate. You're going to get new 6-digit codes. The old one won't work anymore. You're going to get a new number from Google. But you have to go back to Google, Facebook, your bank, Twitter, everywhere you use second-factor authentication and get a new number from them. You know, recreate the number, throw out the old one. Or you could store the code, the QR code. I used to do this. I'd take a picture of it and put it somewhere safe, put it in your LastPass, for instance. And then that way, when you get a new phone, you can redo it by just opening LastPass and using that code again and scanning it. Authy solves this problem by having a central account where these numbers are stored. Now, there's a risk there because now those numbers are being stored on somebody else's server. But Authy does, a good job of encrypting it. They don't have access to it. You can also protect it with a local password as well as an encryption password. So it's highly unlikely that it will leak out. And even if it did, remember, you have to have both the password and the second factor. So that's why we all use Authy, because we change phones a lot. I have a new phone every few months, sometimes more often than that. I don't want to have to set up Google Authenticator every time. So once I use Authy, and I can do it on a phone, I have Authy on my desktop, on my phone, everywhere. And once I set it up, once I set up that new account with a two-factor, and I send it to Authy, it's now in my account. And when I put Authy on a new phone, all of them will be there. So you're still going to have to go back. Your wife's still going to have to go back and recreate all of these second factors, but at least this time, she'll never have to do it again. It'll be in Authie.
Yeah. You know, the thing that's a little confusing to me is when I look at LastPass and they talk about, here's your two-factor authentication methods that we approve, and they have Google Authenticator, but they don't have Authie.
That's because it's called Google Authenticator. It shouldn't be. It's just that there is no name. Well, there's no well-known name for this process, but Google Authenticator works the same way as the LastPass Authenticator, works the same way as the Microsoft Authenticator, works the same way as Authy. They all will give you exactly the same six-digit number. So it doesn't matter.
Right, so I can use Authy.
Absolutely. Anytime you see Google Authenticator, you can use Authy or Microsoft Authenticator or LastPass Authenticator. It's a standard method of taking the long code that's provided by the site and hashing it with the time of day is a standard method.
Yeah, that sounds great. I'm looking forward to putting that on both her phone and mine. So thank you very much.
I think it's the right way to go. I use it all the time, and there is that potential additional risk. But if you think about it, I also added. It's kind of fun, actually. It's an interesting mental exercise to think about security flaws. And you maybe didn't even notice this, but I introduced a security flaw in our discussion because I said, well, what you could do with Google Authenticator is take a picture of the QR code when you get it from the site and store it in LastPass. But that's actually a bad thing to do because the whole reason you're doing this is if a bad guy gets your password, he still needs that second factor. You don't want to put the second factor information in the same place you put the password. Because then if the bad guy gets one, he'll get the other, and you don't have the benefits of second factor. So, in fact, that's why I don't use the LastPass Authenticator. I use Authy. And even if somebody got the Authy account, they still wouldn't have the passwords. But if I store the Authenticator QR code in LastPass, that's actually introducing a flaw, a potential risk. So I think Authy is the best way to go. It's free, too, by the way. Authy, Authy.com. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Twisted Mister says, get a sketch artist to duplicate the authentication code manually. That's a good one. I like it. Yeah, Steve Gibson prints out the QR codes and puts them in a drawer somewhere. That's actually a good method because it's two separate. The idea is to keep this separate somehow. I'm happy. Scooter X has put up, and we'll put in the show notes, a page at Authy, Authy.com, describing the difference between Authy and Google Authenticator. And why you might want to use an authenticator of some kind. Two-factor is really great. It's a simple thing to do. It isn't that difficult. And the biggest difference between authenticator and Authy, well, there's several. One is Google Authenticator doesn't support multiple devices. It's on one phone at a time. You have to order. I guess you can do multiple phones, but it's a manual process. And authenticator is only on iOS and Android, and Authy can also be used on desktop. I think Authy is good. I really like Authy. I think it works quite well. 88, and it's free. 8888, ask Leo. Turn on that two-factor. Turn it on. Steven in San Antonio. Leo Laporte, the tech guy.
Yes, sir. With pardons to your sponsors, but with all this DNA stuff going around and all the hacking and stuff, I wonder, how do I find out which is the best secure if I decided to go DNA, or how do I protect that information once they get a hold of it?
That's a great, I mean, it's a completely fair question. And you mentioned our sponsor, which is 23andMe. So you absolutely, and there are other companies that do DNA analysis. And I think you're right. I think your DNA should be private. It's not like your fingerprint, but it is. It has information in it that could be, I guess, used against you. For instance, if you had a hereditary trait that was caused for medical issues, you wouldn't want that to be leaked out necessarily. So what you absolutely must do before you sign up for any one of these is go to their website and read their policies. Now, 23andMe has a very clear, at the bottom of the page, page dedicated to privacy and data protection. They have a full-time privacy officer, and in my opinion, do exactly the right thing. But you'd have to be the judge. You know, you're right. You don't want this to be leaked out at all.
And then they're pretty much protected from like hackers, just like anybody else in the world.
Well, again, this one's a little harder to judge. They say all the right things. 23andMe employs software, hardware, and physical security measures to protect the computers where customer data is stored. You have to trust that they're doing it right, because even though they describe what they do, you know, as we I think we've learned the bitter lesson that companies sometimes make mistakes and do things wrong.
Exactly.
But yeah, and that's something that's kind of a legitimate concern. I trust them. Now, 23andMe was it's an interesting story. It was started by former wife of one of the Google guys. I think it's Larry Page. And I believe that they have very high quality standards. In fact, they're the only ones I really would trust. Now, maybe one of the things that's gotten this made you aware of this is the recent arrest of a serial killer based on genetic information that was now. But that's the story on that one is a little different because they used a sharing site called GED Match that allows people to put their genetic information up and online. And the police were able to use GED Match. And I think that this will be now this will then be a new way of doing it. They had, of course, DNA information from the killer, from evidence on the scene. And they were able to make the match by looking on the GED Match site, finding relatives, you know, finding kind of close matches, not perfect matches, to the DNA evidence they had. And then with some good detective work, matching the people that they found to this guy because they were his relatives, because they had close DNA matches. So another reason to keep your DNA private if you're a serial killer, it could get you in, get you in trouble. That raises some really interesting issues. But I should point out that that information came from a site where people freely share their genetic information. You can do that. There are ways. Somebody just showed me a site where you can, because 23andMe allows you to download the DNA analysis that they do for you, the raw data. And there's a site where you can upload it and find out more about it. I mean, there's all sorts of interesting uses of this stuff. I would absolutely, before you do, and if you have qualms, don't do it. I don't want to push anybody into doing anything that makes them uncomfortable. So if you say, I'm not going to take the chance, don't. I'm comfortable with it. I did it right away. I did it when they first started. Because I don't think somebody getting my DNA is going to be such a big deal for me. I don't think that's a problem. I don't think there's anything I have to hide. I'm self-insured. I don't have to worry about that. Also because I trust 23andMe. And if you read there about, go to the site and read about it. And before you use any service like this, I would absolutely read the privacy policy. And you're right, the data protection policy. And make sure that you trust them. That's kind of the thing to do. I think 23andMe is the reason we do ads for them is because they're the class act in the bunch. They're the one. Lawn Dog asks an interesting question. Does 23andMe guard their data so well that a nation state couldn't get into it? You know, it's at this point, it'd be hard to say that there is anything that is completely impervious to attack. And the reason you use the nation state as a specter is because they have unlimited resources and hackers, and they can do all sorts of things that an individual can't do. So I would never say anything's impervious, especially to an attack by a nation state. But you might ask, why would a nation state want to do that? What are they looking for? What would they get? If you feel like you could be blackmailed because of your DNA, if there's a family secret you don't want out, and your DNA might reveal that, well, maybe you should consider not using a service like that. I can't think of anything that, you know, I volunteered to publish my DNA. There's something called the Personal Genome Project. It's been going on for some time. That's for the public good. They want people to get the full DNA analysis. And by the way, you pay for it. And then you have to go through a very extensive questionnaire process, matching, you know, your health, your well-being to your DNA. And this is for research purposes because this is how you find genetic markers for disease and stuff. And it's a really great project. And I tried to get in. So I'm one of those people who says, you know, have at it. Here's my DNA. If this is good, if this will help the world, it's out of Harvard. So it's, if this will help the world, I want to do it. But they didn't accept me. So I had to go to 23andMe. So if you're asking me, am I worried? No, obviously not. One of the things the Personal Genome Project says is we're not going to even make an attempt to keep your data private because, you know, we don't think we could do it. So we should let you know if you do this, your name will be attached to your DNA. And then we're going to give it to researchers and we're not going to anonymize it. We want volunteers who are willing to do it and become, for the public good. Oh, I was all up for that. I was all down. I wanted to do it. They wouldn't let me. They've been doing this since 2005. They didn't want my DNA. 8888. I didn't want my DNA. 8888 Ask Leo. That's the phone number. It's a great question. I'm glad people are asking. These are things we should ask. These are questions we should ask. We should pay attention to. Absolutely the right question to ask. And if you don't feel comfortable, you shouldn't do it. I'm Leo Laporte, the tech guy. We're going to take a little break. News coming up at the top of the hour. I will be back with more of your calls. Well, hey, how are you today? Leo Laporte here, the tech guy. Time to talk tech, computers, the internet, home theater, digital photography, encryption, privacy, security. 8888-ASK-LEO is my phone number. 888-827-5536. That's toll free for anywhere in the U.S. or Canada, outside those areas. Still can reach me. Just use Skype or something like that to call, and it shouldn't cost you anything. 888-827-5536. Our website, techguylabs.com, has everything we talk about on the show. It's free. No sign-up needed. You don't have to write anything down. You could even comment, and that's helpful. You don't have to break a blood vessel shouting at me on the radio. You just go to techguylabs.com and shout at me there. Always glad to hear from you, whether you have an additional valuable comment or you're just mad. techguylabs.com. Leon, Glendale, California, you're next. Hi, Leon. Leo Laporte, the tech guy.
Hello, Leo. Long-time fan, and I was just calling in today because I've upgraded from using my phone to record YouTube videos to get back to the community from all I've learned from blacksmithing.
Oh, you're a blacksmith. How cool is that?
Yeah. Got on Forge and Fire, so it's really cool. I've had a lot of fun the past 2 years.
Forge and Fire. Is that the name?
TV show on History Channel.
Oh, neat. So what do you make horseshoes? What do you make?
That's specifically a farrier, and that's around 10% blacksmithing and 90% horsemanship. I primarily do knives and armor.
Knives and armor. Wow. Okay, so you're going to make some smithy videos. Do you already have a channel?
Yeah, it's Vanguard Smithing on YouTube.
Oh, I'm going to go see. How fun. So what can I do to help?
Well, the quality has gotten better since I've started, both in the way I'm shooting and the things I'm using. I went from using my Android, but it may look great on my phone watching them on my phone, but when I translate it to YouTube, it fuzzes it out and dumbs down the quality.
Yeah.
And also on my Samsung Galaxy 8, the focus tends to freak out sometimes, especially since I'm in close-up shots when I'm trying to show a particular technique. So I upgraded to a Logitech 920C webcam.
Yeah.
Which is giving me the right video quality. It may take me 5-10 minutes to set up the lighting properly and all the settings. But now that my video is nice and clear, I still have a slight fuzziness in my voice that I'm, you don't have that nice crisp quality, but I'm also on a budget because most of my money goes towards, you know, supplies and tools, and I can't spend $600 on a camera.
Are you using the built-in microphone on the Logitech for your audio?
Yes.
Yeah. Well, when you're using the Logitech, you really don't have much choice. It doesn't have an input jack for audio, and you really, I guess you could record the audio separately and then spend some time afterwards.
There is a setting to select a different recording setting on the software because it accidentally tried using something else and it didn't work.
Ah!
But there was a setting that I can tell it to use a different software or different device to record the audio.
So you could, so any device that you could get into that laptop would work?
I believe so, yes.
Yeah.
I accidentally recorded a whole video without audio because it was hooked to a different
non-existent
audio source. So.
Yeah, that makes sense. So the software, the Logitech software, will let you choose a different source for the audio. Of course it will, come to think of it. So what you want is some sort of audio input for a laptop. That means USB. There are a lot of USB microphones you could use. And you know, part of the problem with using the Logitech microphone is so distant from you. And it's I presume it's a noisy environment, what with the bellows going, and the flames going, and the hammer going, clong, clong, clong. It's probably a pretty noisy environment. So
it's mainly the hammering, yeah. And I don't mind when the audio kind of tweaks out when I'm trying to talk while hammering, but when I'm just instructing or trying to talk, there's that slight, just the hint of a fuzz that doesn't sound high quality.
Yeah, I'm not sure what you mean by fuzz, but it sounds like the fuzz is clipping. So one of the issues that can happen with audio is if the audio level, if the volume is too high, the recording device will clip it. It will chop the top off, and it'll give it a buzzy sound. And so sometimes people call that. That sounds to me like what you're describing. I can't say for sure. But so one thing in that case to do is to try a lower level. You can get microphones, though, that you could use with your laptop. I would stay with wired, not wireless. Wireless is expensive and has problems. So stick with wired microphones. And you can get a lapel mic. The closer the mic is to your mouth, the better the sound's going to be. I'm watching your video, by the way. This looks so cool.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah, this looks so cool.
Which one? Because there are good ones and bad ones.
Well, which one should I watch?
I guess one of the latest ones, if you can see,
is to always wear eye protection.
Okay, I'm going to listen to this because I hear
there will be slight sparks, and you want to make sure that it doesn't get in your eyes or jump out at you.
Is that the buzzing you're talking about? It's got a little bit of vibration, kind of.
Yeah,
I hear that. That's not clipping.
And while checking your piece, make sure to disconnect.
So you're getting a couple of things going on in here. By the way, this looks awesome. I can't wait to watch this.
Yeah.
A nerd with power tools, you call yourself. So I guess a couple of the issues.
You can painter's tape on a nice little roll.
And some of that is clipping.
Makes life a lot easier.
Some of it is the sound of the room. Getting the microphone closer. This is hard to do. You know, I love it that you're figuring this out. You're doing it all. You figured out the video. The video quality is excellent now.
Yay.
So you're just trying to get the audio, and you're right. You should get it to sound as good as you can. Having a mic closer to you will work better. You'll get less of that room. That echoey sound is the room tone, we call it. And because the microphone is on the camera, it's distant enough. It's, you know, it sounds better. You probably noticed when you're closer to it. And then I do think you're getting some clipping, so turning the level down will help.
You do it during the editing process. Usually I just lower the action almost down to like 30% my own volume.
Yeah, but it's too late by then, because what happens?
That's my quick fix.
yeah, but it's too late. So when you're recording, if you think of your voice as a sine wave, it's a nice smooth curve. What happens if it's too loud is the top of the curve gets chopped off. You get what's called a sawtooth, and that actually sounds buzzy. That's the clipping, we call it. It's chopping off the top of the curve. You want a nice smooth curve. So turn it down. But you would, I think best probably for you would be, and it's not expensive, understanding that you have limitations, is the kind of headset mic you use on Skype. because it's going to get a mic closer to your mouth. That's going to get rid of the room sounds. It's going to eliminate also any clanging and banging and forge sounds. And those mics are not expensive, but they are fairly good quality. So the things you'll have to watch, a couple of things you'll have to watch out for. One is popping your peas, getting air into the mic. So you position it a little bit away from your mouth. And the other thing is, again, this overmodulation. So you're really, when you record, look at the sound, look at the wave, and don't let the wave hit the top of the bar. You want to get it a little bit below it so there's a little space so it won't chop the tops off of those curves. If that makes sense.
So whatever software I use, I have to make sure I have something where I can see that?
Yeah, and you can. In your, there'll be ways that you can see that. Whatever you're recording with, you'll be able to look at the audio. You just want to keep it below. You don't want it to go in the red, or you don't want the wave to go above the line. Or, you know, you can do it just by ear. Turn it down. And you can always turn it up in... See, you can recover it by turning it up, but you can't get it back by turning it down after you've recorded it. The other thing is the microphone itself can clip. Microphones themselves have a limit to how much sound they can take. So I can, even though I've set all my levels carefully, you know, we're professional biz, you know, radios, you know, but we've set all the levels carefully, but I can talk too loudly for the microphone and make a clip. So you want to be careful you don't do that either. All of this you will be able to see in whatever you're recording with. And just experiment and try lower levels, I think, would be the first thing. Go out and get a USB. We use a Plantronics USB headset mic. They're $40 or $50. They're not expensive. And that, because it's so closely mic'd, I think will make it sound a lot better. And people should go subscribe to your channel, Vanguard Smithing, and you can learn how to make your own armor. Very useful. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. This is so cool. I congratulate you on doing this. That's really cool. That's really cool.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah. I've called KFI before. I didn't want to try plugging myself, but thank you for automatically.
Oh, yeah. No, I don't mind people plugging their podcasts. I think that's good. I like to do that.
Yeah, there's so many things that I wish someone would have shown me more clearly online for armoring and for thing videos. I'm like, well, I've learned so much from YouTube, I should give back, but it takes me around 5 hours just to edit.
I'm
a blacksmith, not a tech guy, so.
Well, I think people underestimate how hard this stuff is, you know? It's a whole new skill you're learning. But that's what makes YouTube so great. There is nothing you can't learn on YouTube. I mean, it's amazing. Yeah. And I bet you there are a lot of people who want to make armor for cosplay and stuff. This is great.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I only know of two other guys in the Los Angeles community that make real armor for cosplay. I've seen people, maybe five or six people that wear armor, but I only know of two guys that actually make the armor to go. And one of them works for Tony Swan over at Man at Arms. So he actually made the Infinity Gauntlet.
You're kidding!
Marvel, so.
Oh, how cool is that? Wow, your armor is beautiful.
Jumanji. I did some of the random barbarian guys in Jumanji. It's all I've done.
Oh, good for you. So you can work in the business, too.
Slowly getting my own skill up, so I'll get noticed eventually, yeah.
Good for you. Well, keep up the good work. You're doing great.
Thank you.
Nice to talk to you, Leon.
Nice to talk to you, and like I said, been a long-time fan. It was nice to finally call in.
I'm glad we could help. Stay, you know, keep doing it. All right, take care.
Because metal is all made up of all different kinds of grains. But if you go to a work hardened state,
it sounds a little clipped,
I think. Under work or stress, non-ferrous, non-iron materials tend to compress into a grain structure.
I mean, it's not bad. Shape. It's intelligible, at least, right?
It's good because now your material is harder, it's stiffer, and it takes a lot more to move it. But it also means that if you try to move it, there's more likely to get cracks and breaks in the structure. This structure here will bend and be very pliable. This one will spring and will resist movement. And if you try moving it, a lot of times you'll get actual fractures and cracks in your metal. If you go to try bending your metal and it starts to show stress very early on.
Very cool.
Or if you're working it.
Leo Laporte, the tech guy. I got geek, babe. Chris Marquardt, our photo guy's here. He's going to do a review of your pictures coming up in just a few minutes. But first, Lori in Santa Monica. Hi, Lori.
Hi, Leo.
Welcome.
I'm baking cookies.
Oh, don't do that to me, Laurie. What kind of cookies?
Chocolate chip.
From scratch?
Yes, actually.
Oh, are you use the Toll House recipe on the back of the chips, or you have your own?
No, my son's swim coach, funny enough, gave me this recipe and said he'll give him a free month of swimming if I bake him these cookies.
Oh, that's a deal.
It's that recipe, yeah.
That's a deal.
On to you. Yeah.
That sounds good. All right.
They look pretty good.
I take it you're not calling it. Oh, no, we lost her. Did you hear that bump? Oh, it went away. I don't know if her phone died. I didn't do anything. I swear, I didn't touch a button. Call back, Lori. We'll get you back on if you can call back. Oh, man. Probably the cookies were done. That's it with you, Leo. I'm eating cookies. Bob in San Jose, Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Hi, Bob. Hey, run to the phone, Bob. Hello, Bob. Am I talking to Bob?
You are.
Hi, Bob.
Hey, Leo. Sorry.
There's an old drinking game when you watch the Bob Newhart show. Every time somebody says, hi, Bob, you're supposed to drink.
Oh, man. My favorite show ever.
I bet.
Oh, my gosh. And what about Bob? That was my
what
favorite.
What about Bob? You only like things with Bob in it.
Well, you know.
What can I do for you, Bob?
Well, Leo, we were probably crossing paths on Highway 17 back in the early 70s. I think you were over in Santa Cruz.
Yeah.
Growing up in Sunnyvale, Fremont High School. And
drove over that hill many a time.
Yeah, yeah. But, hey, I had an interesting thing happen. I kind of took your advice, bought a Samsung S9, Galaxy S9 Plus.
Good. Do you like it?
Love the phone. It's awesome. My hand is not as big as I thought it was, though. It takes a big, meaty mitt.
it's a hefty phone. But see, I think we're moving in that direction because people use their phones as computers as much as your phone. And bigger screens are easier to use. They're easier to type on, easier to see. So phones seem to be getting bigger. They don't seem to be getting smaller.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Anyway, I love the phone. The thing is that about a day after I got it home, I was going through my contacts and, everything transferred over. But then I got about 300 contacts that are not mine.
What?
Yeah.
Whose are they? Yeah. Can you tell?
Well, they belong. I think they belong to an architect in Idaho.
Oh, that's not good.
Because there's a lot of construction, landscape.
Oh, that's terrible. So you got the phone new, right?
Brand new from the AT&T store.
Okay. Well, there's the first thing. Make sure it really was new.
How would I know, though? I mean, it had all the wrapping. It had, you know.
It probably was new, but it is conceivable that AT&T had sold it once before and didn't wipe it properly. That's one possibility. Did you sign into a Samsung account?
No, I didn't. I have never had a Samsung account.
Okay, so that's
before.
That the Samsung does sync contacts on a Samsung account, and that could be a place you got. So you're only signed into your Google account?
Correct.
Highly unlikely that anybody's contacts would get mixed into your Google account. Google is, I could see Samsung screwing up that way, but I don't see Google screwing up that way.
Yeah.
So that's.
Somebody had this phone before?
I'm thinking that's probably the case. It's not, you know, you can seal up a box and make it look like it's brand new, and it's not legal to do that, but they have to get caught.
Yeah.
In California, the law changed. For a long time, people did do that. That, you know, if a phone's, I mean, really, it is new. If a phone's returned and it's, you know, as good as new and put back in the box, people used to sell those as new. And the state of California some time ago made a law saying they can't do that. That actually created a whole market of refurbished computers and computer outlets and stuff where people were selling stuff that had been not hardly used. And that's what AT&T should do, or Samsung should do with that phone if it's been used. I can only think it's if you didn't sign up for a Samsung account, you don't have another app on there that's syncing contacts. You don't have multiple contact apps on there.
No. I only use Google contacts.
Yeah. There's no way Google's going to get somebody mixed into your contacts. I mean, It shouldn't happen to anybody, so I guess it could happen to Google. I've never heard of such a thing. It seems Google, of all the companies out there, seems to me the most tech savvy and the least likely to have a problem like that. But I guess it's possible. To me, I would say more likely that AT&T didn't wipe the phone completely.
Yeah.
You could call some of those numbers, see if you could track the guy down and say, hey, did you have an S9 Plus and bring it back to AT&T?
Yeah.
Wouldn't that be funny?
For a contact that said, like, mom or home or wife.
None of that, though, huh?
None of that.
So what I would do, just to be prudent, is wipe the phone. In the settings, there's the factory data reset. Just wipe the phone. That really will get rid of everything. And by the way, even if you do that and you resync the phone, those contacts are probably in your Google contacts now. So you want to delete those from your Google contacts as well.
Which is like a long process.
I think
sort it by phone number and then do it that way.
Yeah, sort it by area code. Yeah, because it's not your area code. But yeah, it's a pain. Did you put an SD card in there? Somebody's asking. That's a good question.
I did. Out of my Motorola phone went right into there. The guy put it in. You have to use a special tool to pop the thing off.
Really?
I think there's a thing on the top of the phone you have to push. I mean, I don't know.
Yeah, it's a SIM. It's the same thing as the SIM puller thing, a little poker.
Correct.
Yeah.
Right.
Because I put my own SD card. Yeah, I'm a pro. I put my own SD cards in. But it's not that hard. But that could be another source of it. Or even the SIM card, by the way. Where'd you get the SIM card?
It was all done at the AT&T.
So that may be, sometimes, I don't know if a SIM card could hold 300 contacts, but maybe it could. That's another source. You can see that in the settings if the contacts come from the SIM and the phone. So that might have been that they gave you a used SIM card, and that could happen just by kind of some mix-up at the factory.
Yeah, okay.
I wouldn't assume that it's a used phone. If it seems new and it came new in the box and stuff, who knows how those got in there, but the easiest thing to do, and I would do it, if it is a used phone, you probably want to wipe it again just to make sure. You don't want anything else.
The small issue I have with the phone is every time I go to the Play Store and download an app, it just hangs up and I have to restart the phone.
Okay, that's not right either. It's time to wipe that phone. So. Do a factory reset. I don't have any of those problems with my S9 Plus. I love that S9. I think it's a wonderful phone.
Yeah.
And that should I install apps all the time on it, never have that problem. Yeah, I think it's time for a reset. I'm guessing that might have been not exactly brand new.
Yeah.
That's my best guess.
For 900 and whatever.
I know. I'd maybe bring it back and yell at him. Say, hey, I need a new phone. This might be a good reason to do it, I think. Chris Marquardt coming up right after this. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Chris Marquardt is here. He's our photo guy. Joins us every week to talk about getting better pictures. Fun photography stuff. Hi, Chris. Welcome back from New York.
Hi there. How are you?
You were in doing a tilt shift workshop. That's cool.
Tilt shift photography in New York. I'll talk a bit more about this next week, even though I guess most people don't have a tilt shift lens. But it's kind of interesting to see what these things can do.
How versatile
they are.
Yeah. But we can't do that today because we've got an assignment review. We're ready to look at our feet pictures, our foots pictures.
I was kind of worried what kind of pictures we'd get, and lots of people took this very literal. So we got a whole bunch of photos of feet, of actual feet. And I've chosen three. Well, the first one is kind of about feet. The second and third one look at this from a bit of a different angle, which I thought very creative. So first one by Gerald Wiley, titled Puddle Reflection. And what we're looking at is there's a kind of a seashore, there's a reflection of a guy, but when you look at the actual guy, he's not there. So it's a reflection that reflects something that's not there. The only thing that's there is his umbrella and the boots. So,
noticed that. Oh, that's so cool. Yeah.
So, it's a trick shot. It's of course photoshopped. I think it's a pretty funny idea, and it It's not too hard to do. If you know kind of know how to do something like Photoshop or Affinity Photo or other image editing software that can do layers, what you would do is you would take a photo with the person, then a photo without the person, and then you can kind of take one part of that photo, the upper part from one layer and the lower part from another layer, and with a bit of editing, this is a relatively simple montage to do, but the effect is amazing, isn't it? So 2 feet.
I love it.
In boots, and then the boots without the feet. So good job, Gerald. Next photo is by Larry Albor as SF Full Moon Punctuation. So what we're looking at is skyline of San Francisco. It shows the
that middle thing is Salesforce the Salesforce Tower. Yeah.
Yes.
That's the newest and building on the San Francisco skyline.
Larry is using the Salesforce Tower as a foot to rest the moon on. So he's taking this with the long lens. So the moon is nice and big in the photo, and the where he's positioned is that the Salesforce Tower is right under the full moon, and it's the full blue moon. And I'm pretty sure Larry did a bit of calculations or looked it up in something like the Photographer's Ephemeris, which is an app where you can see where things will be. So I'm pretty sure he planned this one out to be at the right spot at the right time and get this photo where the moon rests on top of the building.
That's a really cool use of that building. I think I hate that building. It ruined the San Francisco skyline.
I haven't seen it in person yet. It must be really new.
Yeah, and it's, Mark Benioff and Salesforce sold it. And they got some weird plans for that top part. They want to do projection screens on it so you can see stuff from the all around it. It's taller than any other building in San Francisco. It kind of dwarfs the rest of the city. And I think it's kind of ugly. But anyway, it's there, so we're going to live with it. But I love what he did with it. That really works. Now, how did he get the moon? Because the moon's not too bright. You can actually see features of the moon.
Well, if you look at the exposure time, he's shooting that. First of all, he's shooting this with a 400-millimeter lens, and he's shooting it at f/8, an eighth of a second, ISO 400. So that is almost like daylight settings. So it wasn't really dark when he took this picture.
Okay.
It was during dawn. You can see how blue the sky is. So it's almost the blue hour. The first lights in the buildings, in the windows have come on. So it's right during that time when it's starting to get dark, but it's not really dark
in
quite
fact,
yet.
You might be able to see the sun rising in the Bank of America Tower. Right
possible,
next to
yeah.
It. Yeah, there's sort of a sunrise. Well, this is a lot of props to him. This is a well thought out, planned shot. Spent some energy.
Absolutely.
On it. Yeah.
And last but not least, again, Gerald Wiley, the guy who did the photo with the Photoshop thing 2 photos ago.
He's back.
And he's
baby.
Allowed to do this. Well, he's
You're allowed,
allowed
to win
this.
Twice in 1 week?
Well, the rules are you can submit one picture per assignment per week. And as this assignment has been up for over 5 weeks now, he had the chance to submit several pictures. And when I choose pictures for review, I never look at who took them. It's only by the picture itself. So
good for
Gerald
him.
Got lucky here. But it's a very different photo because its title is Maddie Packs a Punch. And what you see is a cat, a black That's cat, awesome. And it's pawing at a, what is that, a dandelion?
Yeah.
How do you call them when they're aged and when they're, I don't know.
Gone to seed. Gone to seed, we say.
All right.
Yeah, so, that is a great picture. I love that picture.
It is, and the cat is pawing that. And so you see, it's not a foot, it's a paw, which I think would translate to being a hand more. But anyway, it's the cat is in the background, out of focus. The dandelion is in focus, and you can see, well, the ears of the cat itself, but not the face, just an eye or two eyes kind of looking at the dandelion. So that's a perfect angle. The focus is exactly where it has to be. You kind of see a bit of motion in the paw. So that it tells a story.
Yeah.
It gets you to complete that story. What's going to happen next? What happened before? And very good, very good shot.
You know what I like about all three of these shots? They're not serendipitous. It looks like in all three cases the photographer thought about what he was looking for. He did a what do they call that? Photo pre-visualization of
pre-visualization,
what the,
yeah, yes.
of what the photo, what he was looking for, she was looking for, and then they kind of went for it. And I think that that's a really interesting idea. An interesting
even topic. With the last one with the cat, I mean, he must have taken tens of photos there yeah. just to get that one. But
he's poking her with a dandelion, I'm sure.
There's a composition. There's yeah. a deliberate focus. It's just a matter of finding the right moment.
We have
a new assignment.
Oh, good. Let's do it. What is it?
We finished the foot assignment. Next one is hand.
I guess that
makes
sense.
That should be cool.
Hand would. Now remember, it doesn't have to be a hand.
It could
be a paw. It could be anything.
I have a tendency to choose photos that are not literal. So
notice there are no pictures of feet in these last three shots. So whatever hand means to you, and it could mean a lot of different things, you want to take a picture. Hey, here's the good news. The site we use for photo sharing, Flickr, which I've loved for years, was a Yahoo property and was acquired by Verizon. It was part of Oath. And we were, I think, all a little nervous about what this phone company would do with a very important resource to photographers. So the very, very good news, which happened a couple of weeks ago, is that Flickr was purchased by a small but beloved company called Smug Mug. I'm a Smug Mug customer, have been since day one. That's where I put my photos. If you go to leo.camera, that's a Smug Mug site. The McCaskills are it's a family-run business. You couldn't find a better steward for Flickr. It makes me so happy.
And these guys love photography. They've never taken venture capital, so they are into it for the photography. And I think that's really good news for Flickr.
They're photographers themselves, very talented yes. photographers, and they made a site that was really designed for professionals to use. And I just couldn't be happier. I'm kind of blown away that Smug Mug got it, and I'm very excited to see what they do with it. So upload your picture to Smug Mug, tag it with the word hand, submit it to the Tech Guy group. Our moderator, Renee Silverman, will welcome you into the group. And in a month, we're going to pick the best. Leo Laporte, the Tech Guy. Yeah, such good news. Chris and Don. Don's the father and Chris is the son, I think.
It's a father and son business.
Yeah, maybe Chris is the father and Don's the son, but that is the greatest site ever. I'm so pleased. I hope they have the resources to do something.
It's also interesting because Smug Mug never had a freemium model as Flickr does.
Always paid. So I'm always paid.
I'm interested how this is going to move forward. But for now, they don't want to change anything. And yeah, we'll see how this pans out, but I think it's really good news.
Flickr is a little desperate for an update.
Yes, they had a bit of a... They were on life support for a while, getting the bare minimum of fixes.
Well, for instance, the slideshow still uses Flash.
Oh, yeah, that is useless now. Yeah, mostly useless.
Yeah, so there's just things that Flickr is like a well-worn classic vehicle that just needs a little TLC. And I don't know what Smug Mug will end up doing. They may just kind of, because Smug Mug itself, is a nice code base. They may just fold it right into it. I don't know.
Well, they they got access to a sizable community of photographers. So.
Oh yeah, I mean, I pay I think $140 a year for a Smug Mug.
And I just hope that they will not alienate the Flickr crowd. There's so many great integrations with Flickr. If you're a film photographer, you go to filmdev.org. They have an integration with Flickr. So if you have photos on that site and on Flickr, you get a little like the film EXIF data, what film that was shot on, how it was developed, that kind of stuff inside Flickr. So it's a really really good kind of vehicle for a lot of services that rely on Flickr, and we'll rely on it too here in the show. So it is, it's hopefully going to keep all these things alive.
Leo Laporte, the Tech Guy, 8888. Ask Leo. We have our assignment. Hand. And you'll have about 4 weeks before Chris Marquardt picks three pictures and talks about them on the radio. Kind of crazy idea, but it seems to work. And it's really just an excuse to get out there and take pictures. Take some photos. Hand. You tag it with the word hand, upload it to Flickr, and then submit it to the Tech Guy group. Lori, Santa Monica, Leo Laporte, the Tech Guy. Hi, Lori.
Hi, Leo. Sorry, I was multitasking making cookies before, so I hung up on you.
Oh, you hung up on me. Oh, thank goodness, because sometimes I hang up on people and I feel terrible.
No, I think it was my fault.
I was all excited talking about your cookies, and then you went, boop, disappeared.
I know. So here's my question. I'm traveling with my husband and my two teenagers to London and to Paris. And we all have iPhones.
Yeah.
And I'm trying to figure out the best solution. I have Verizon with one, and one kid has Verizon, and my husband and another kid have AT&T. And they have their separate plans, and I know you can go there and get a SIM card. But
so the first thing you do is you call AT&T and Verizon. You may have already done this. And said,
we did.
And say, what are your international plans?
Yeah.
And then after you get over choking, you can look at some other options.
They've
gotten better. You know, for a while it was ridiculous, but I think it was like Verizon was 100 megabytes for I think $25. It was ridiculous, unusable.
It's crazy. Yeah.
Fortunately, because T-Mobile has kind of put the screws to these other guys, because they were giving away slow but free data internationally, and so everybody, Sprint, Verizon, and AT&T, they've come up with something better for international, but still not necessarily the most economical. How long are you going to be there?
2 weeks.
Okay. So that's going to add up. And you really do want data when you're traveling. It's if nothing else, it's insurance. If you get lost, you can use Google Maps to find your hotel. In most cases, your hotel will have Wi-Fi. Restaurants, coffee shops will have Wi-Fi. And with Google Maps, you can – and this is something I don't think people really know, but if you look in the menu – you can download ahead of time the Google Maps for London and Paris, so you'll have those and you don't need data to access them.
Right, okay.
But it's still nice to have data.
Well, what if you want to call an Uber and you're out on the street?
Right. You need data.
Yeah.
So, there are several choices. One, of course, is to wait till you get to those countries and buy something. Now, there is a rule in the EU that the phone companies in the EU have to offer roaming at the same cost in all the countries of the EU. But as you know, England is about to leave the EU, but I think it's still technically in it. So you probably can get to London and buy either. I wouldn't get SIMs. So a lot of people say, oh, I'm just going to buy an international SIM. Well, if you do that, you certainly get a good low cost data and texting. But calls to America may be very expensive, and you get a whole new phone number. You don't get to keep your old number. So people trying to reach you aren't going to be able to reach you on your phone. I like keeping my old number just in case.
Right.
So putting a SIM in, while maybe the most economical, may not be the best way to do this. You can also, when you get there, get something. I call them a MiFi card, but they're basically little Wi-Fi access points, battery-powered, that get their data from the local cell connection. And then you turn data roaming off. This is very important. Turn international data roaming off on your phones. They won't then be using international data. That's the really expensive thing. And they'll, mm-hmm. and then they can use these Wi-Fi access points. You carry it around with you, and you all can join it. You know, all four of you can use it. And usually that's fairly economical. Now, you can wait until you get there, or you can buy it now. If you go, I'm going to give you a website. I'm not going to give you the URL because it's complicated, but I'm going to say Google the words prepaid with data wiki. It's the prepaid with data wiki, and it has all the information on each country, what the prices are. It's kept up to date by Travelers, what the best ways to do this. It'll give you all the options you have available.
Now, okay.
I talked about this yesterday. One of the things I did is I bought something called a Skyroam Solus. It's at skyroam.com. Because we travel a lot. So if you travel a lot, this might be the most, maybe not the most economical, but certainly the most convenient thing to do. It is one of those Wi-Fi access points, but you don't have to set it up for the country that you're in. It works in 120 countries without any configuration. You buy it or you can rent it. I bought it for $150. Now I own it. It's a big orange hockey puck. literally the size of a hockey puck. It's got a 16-hour battery in it, which is really good. Most of these other devices will last 5 or 6 hours. So 16-hour battery. You can even charge your phone with it. It's got such a big battery. And you can have up to 5 Wi-Fi devices connected to it. Now, here's the downside. It's a little pricey. Besides buying it for $150, then you buy day passes for $9. You'll be gone for 2 weeks. You probably just get the monthly $99 plan. That means all four of you for $99 will have unlimited Wi-Fi at fairly high speeds, at the LTE speeds where you are.
Huh.
That's what we did. We were in Japan and Korea last month, and that's what we did. We're going to go to Europe in the fall. That will work there. So that's another choice. But that's really most useful for people who travel enough to justify the $150.
Right. But you said you can rent it, too.
You can rent it. Then it's $8 or $9. I think it's $9 a day. And then send it back. The nice thing about this is you don't pay for it when you're not using it. So when you get home, there's no, you know, you turn off the subscription. It just sits there until you travel again.
Right. Okay. Okay. And the MiFi cards you can buy when you get there, or you can buy them ahead.
Go to Prepaid with Data Wiki just to do some research. I did when I was in London. I got it from Three, which is one of the London carriers. It was very good. It's fairly inexpensive. They give you, I think it was $30 for unlimited for the whole month. And it's a Wi-Fi thing, but it didn't have much battery life. So we would get about half the day. You have to just carry a little battery and pack with it.
Right. Okay.
And so there's different, but this Prepaid with Data, we'll talk about all the options. You want something that's going to work in London and Paris, if possible. You don't want to have to get something in both cities.
Right. Right. Okay. And the MiFi card will, because.
Well, in theory, because of these EU regulations, but as we know, Brexit is fast approaching. So I don't know. Okay. I don't know how that's going to change things.
Okay. Okay. All right. Cool. Thank you.
You're welcome. Have fun. It's going to be a great trip. First time there for the kids?
It will be their first time. Yeah. My son's graduating. He's taken 4 years of French. So we thought.
You can let him translate.
Yeah. Yeah. That's the idea.
That's a great. Two of my favorite cities. That's going to be a great trip. You're going to love that.
What thank fun. You.
Have a great time. Yeah. Bring
all
cookies.
Right, thanks a lot.
Bring.
Oh, yeah. I don't think they'll make it.
have a nice trip. Yeah, this is it's funny. I get this question all the time, especially as we get closer to summer and people getting ready to travel. Keep that link. And we'll put that in the show notes too, because that website, Prepaid with Data Wiki, is really well done and is up to date because travelers keep it up to date. It's a wiki. Wiki means that anybody can edit it, like Wikipedia, right? So people go in there and they say, hey, I just came back and this is how much Three cost me, and that kind of thing. And everybody has, you know, an opinion. Oh, this is the best. This is the best. So it's good to see all the choices you have. Prepaid. Just Google it, and you can get to it right away. Prepaid with Data Wiki. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Hey, I got to mention our sponsor for the podcast. And I'm always happy to do so. They really have been supportive of all of our shows for the last more than a year, I think. Rocket Mortgage from Quicken Loans. And I have to say, I'm going to take a little credit because in the intervening time since they started advertising, Quicken Loans became the number one home lender in the country. Yeah, maybe I had a little to do with that, right? Maybe you did, supporting them. We're so glad they support us. Quicken Loans, best lender in the country. They've always been number one in customer satisfaction, 8 years in a row. But they became the number one in volume towards the end of last year, beating the big bank, you know, the one with the horses and the carriage. They beat the big bank in loans written. That's awesome. And I think some of this has to do with Rocket Mortgage, their online loan approval process. It's entirely online. This is what, I think Quicken Loans realized that the idea of going to a bank, begging for money, filling out a long application, getting paperwork, you know, going to the attic to get your pay stubs, your bank statements. That's just really antiquated. They realized there needed to be a more modern way to get a loan. So they created Rocket Mortgage. The whole thing is on your phone or your laptop. You do the whole thing. And well, you could go right now to rocketmortgage.com/techguy and see. You answer a few simple questions. They have relationships with all the financial institutions. So as soon as you give them permission, they can get the data they need. You don't have to go to the attic. They'll do it all for you. They crunch the numbers based on income, assets, and credit, yours, obviously, they will say, here's the loans you qualify for. You choose the rate, the down payment, the term, and they approve you. And all of this usually less than 10 minutes. Like fast enough that you could say, you should bank, at least bookmark rocketmortgage.com/tech guy. You really want to speed it up, cut a couple of minutes off it. You know, just sign up for an account. Doesn't mean anything. Just sign up for an account. And then you're in an open house, maybe this afternoon. Hey, we should buy this. Oh, can we get the loan? I don't know. Let me. You boom, boom, boom. You apply simply. You'll understand fully what's going on. They say, here's the loans. You say, yeah, I'll take it. More. And then, boom, you're approved. Big green button. And you show the realtor. This is in just a few minutes. Yeah, we're approved. We'd like to make an offer. We are pre-approved. We're good for it. Rocket Mortgage. Apply simply. Understand fully. Mortgage confidently. It seems obvious, right? I don't know why no one did this before. Thank you, Quicken Loans. Equal housing lender, licensed in all 50 states, NMLSconsumerAccess.org, number 3030, rocketmortgage.com/tech guy. It's when something's really right, when something makes sense, it just seems like, well, obviously, that's it. rocketmortgage.com/tech guy. We thank him for supporting the whole, making 2018 and 2017 sing on the Tech Guy Show. No, I'm not going to sing. Don't worry. Well, hey. How are you today? Leo Laporte here, the Tech Guy. This is the show where we talk about computers and the internet, and we talk about home theater and digital photography. We talk about smart watches, smartphones, everything changing this world around us, all that technology, how to use it, how to abuse it, how to lose it when you're done. 8888 Ask Leo. That's usually the order, but you can mess around with it a little bit. Could lose it, then abuse it, and choose it. 8888 Ask Leo. That's the phone number. If you have a question, a comment, a suggestion, 888-827-5536. We also can be visited in our chat room at irc.twit.tv. That's kind of a fun place to go. Family friendly, kids in the back of the class kind of helping me out. Team Tech Guy, irc.twit.tv. And all of this is listed at the website. That's probably the best thing to remember, techguylabs.com. Back to the phones we go. Julie, she's next in Valencia, California. Hi, Julie.
Oh.
Hi, welcome. Hello, Julie.
Hi.
Hey. What can I do for you today? You're on the air.
Oh, my gosh. I have been waiting to talk to you for so long, and I never get through, so I'm so happy.
Yay! I'm sorry you were on hold so long, and I'm glad you maintained.
I'm thrilled to talk to you.
Yay!
Here's my problem. I have been working at my employer for 25 years, and I shattered my ankle and I went out on disability, and they took the opportunity to send me an email to tell me I was terminated. Yes.
Is that even legal?
We're fixing to find out about that.
I guess it's California. It's an at-will state. Maybe it is. I don't know. But I would definitely get some counsel on that.
I'm meeting with counsel tomorrow.
Good.
So
that seems pretty. That seems pretty rotten.
It's horrible.
Yeah. After 25, I could see if you were, you know, had been there 6 months. 25 years. Come on, man.
I know. That's what I thought too. It's just not right. So I have a laptop that I need to get back to them, and I want to try and clear it off before I return it to them. And I don't know how, because it's got this program on it called ForcePoint.
All right. So now you're going to talk to a lawyer tomorrow, so he'll tell you the same thing. That's company property.
Right.
Everything that's on that, even if you put it there and it's personal, belongs to them. Mm-hmm. The reason that ForcePoint is on there is to prevent you from doing what you want to do. And you could even get in trouble for doing what you want to do.
Okay.
That's their stuff.
Okay.
Sorry.
That being said, is there any
sorry? So you have stuff on there that's personal that you don't want them to see?
Well, it's just my, you know, it's like my pictures and, you know, letters and stuff
yeah.
like that. It's
so this is a valuable, you've been there a long time. You trusted them. You thought it was, you know, but it's a valuable lesson for anybody who's using a work computer.
Mm-hmm.
You shouldn't put your personal stuff on that because that's theirs. And,
right.
and you know, it's going to be. So I'm looking at ForcePoint right now. Protect users and data by dynamically mitigating risk in seconds. Somewhere in this whole thing about, you know, dynamically mitigating risk, it probably says, and then they can't delete their stuff when they want to.
Right, exactly.
There's no way they can stop you from actually wiping that hard drive. I'm not saying you can't do it physically. You can.
Uh-huh.
I'm just saying you, when you meet with your attorney, ask them about that before you do this.
Well, I met with one other attorney that I'm not going to go with, but he told me, give me your computer and I'll wipe it before you return it. So,
yeah, let him do it. Then he's liable. So it's easy to wipe a computer regardless of ForcePoint or anything else on it, because what you're going to do is you're going to wipe it before ForcePoint loads. So,
okay.
So what you're going to do is you're going to make a disk, a USB, usually it's a USB thumb drive, depends on the age and the kind of computer. But usually if a computer can boot from a USB thumb drive, you can boot up into the thumb drive, not into the desktop, and then run removal software that'll wipe the disk. And it'll wipe it completely clean, including all their stuff.
Okay.
Now, you could go in there and just delete your stuff, but the problem is that deleting stuff doesn't get rid of it. Is it a Windows 10 laptop?
Yes.
Okay. So I think it's sufficient, and I think this would actually be a reasonable thing to do. Windows 10 has a secure erase feature that will allow you to securely erase the data that you put in the trash can, the recycle bin. And that way you don't have to wipe the whole computer, which they may could get them a little angry.
Right.
You don't want to cause, you know, more problems, or in a way you don't want to really open yourself up to liability in case you do decide to sue them. You don't want to give them an avenue to countersue.
Mm-hmm.
Again, your lawyer will be an expert on this. But there is a way to securely empty the recycle bin in Windows.
Okay.
So there are a couple of ways to do this. There's a program that probably be the best way to do this called Eraser, E-R-A-S-E-R.
Mm-hmm.
Now it may, if you can't install it because of...
Yeah, I won't be able to.
You can't install third-party apps on your on your computer without permission at all.
Correct.
Okay, good to know. All right, they really locked it down.
Yeah, they did.
All right, well, nevertheless, you can do this. It's just more complicated by creating a bootable USB thumb drive and then erasing files that you want to erase. Generally, when you do that, you're just going to erase the whole darn thing. Yeah, it's too bad. You know, on a Macintosh, they have it's built in the secure erase, but I don't think Windows 10 has a built in. So erasing, putting something in a recycle bin and hitting the erase is actually not erasing the data. It's all still there. So if you think that they might want to go into your data, then that's not going to really do the job.
Yeah.
So do you have how comfortable are you with technology? Can you, for instance, if I said make a bootable USB disk, would you know how to do that?
No.
Okay.
Sorry.
No, don't apologize to me. I'm just trying to assess how much information I'm going to have to give you.
Okay.
There's two programs. There's the Eraser program.
Mm-hmm.
That's open source and free from eraser.hidi.ie, which is Ireland. Eraser.hidi.ie. Is that Ireland? Or you can get a program called Derek's Boot Nuke, DBAN, which will erase the whole dang thing securely. Both cases, the data is not recoverable. So when you use these programs, it will erase, either selectively erase files or erase the whole hard drive. The problem with selective eraser is if you boot from an external disk, you may not have access to those files. You might have to log into your computer, in which case the only thing you can do is erase the whole darn hard drive. They may not like that. Okay. Now, if I'm the boss at your but I would never have fired you. But if I was the boss or the IT guy there, I would say, well, I'm going to erase it anyway because we don't know what's happened. You start over anyway.
Right.
You never, you know. So there are – so either Heidi's eraser tool or DBAN, you can boot – if you can boot to an external drive, you can use on the internal drive. But you have to be able to make a bootable USB drive.
Okay.
And if the drive is encrypted or locked down, you're going to have to erase the whole thing. And again, consult your attorney before you do that.
Okay.
So I have to take a break, but it's a little complicated to make a bootable USB key. But if you look up bootable USB drive, you will find a way to create one. Probably the easiest thing to do would be to create a Linux disk that you could then use to erase the hard drive. But this might take a little more expertise. Somebody who has some expertise can easily do this, as long as you're willing to take the liability.
Okay.
All right. Let me see. Right. Somebody's suggesting Etcher. Let me see. What I really want, I'm looking for, is something that will make a USB drive that you can boot from and have the eraser stuff on it.
Oh, that would be great.
And I'm sure somebody's doing that. Let me take a break and I'll talk when we come back. I bet you I can find you something that'll do that. That's what you really want. Just a program you'd run. Well, but you can't install programs on your computer. You'd have to do this on somebody else's computer that lets you do this. The fact that they put that software on there tells me they don't want you to do this. We're taking a break. Let me see if we can, I'll see if I can help Julie build a boot disk and erase her drive. When we get back, Leo Laporte, the tech guy. So there are. Your problem is going to be if they're not letting you install programs on that computer, you're going to have to make the boot. You're going to have to get a USB drive, and you're going to have to make it on another computer. Do you have a computer at home or somebody you can borrow?
I do.
Okay. So then you can do that, because otherwise you couldn't install the program you need to make the boot CD. So you're going to make a boot thumb drive. And there are a number of Windows boot CDs. One is Hirens, H-I-R-E-N-S, boot. cd.org, perfectly good. It has, you'll download the tool. It has on the website, tells you how to create a USB bootable flash drive with Hirens.
Okay.
And then when you boot to it, it's not booting into Windows. It's booting into their own, probably Linux, I think, but their own operating system. And then in there, in the tools on that disk, there is a disk erasing utility that's a secure erase utility.
Oh, okay.
I'm pretty sure. I'm just looking at what's on here. You know, it's actually, everybody should have one of these, because if you have problems with your computer, this is a really good tool. So keep that USB key for future reference.
Okay.
I'm just looking if they have DBAN on here or what. They'll have a way to erase the entire drive securely. But again, I would make sure that you're not going to get... See, if you're thinking about suing them, the first thing they're going to do is say, well, she wiped company data off of their computer. And they're going to countersue. So I would ask the lawyer, make sure you're protected here.
Okay, I will ask her tomorrow. I have 25 years worth of wrongdoings on their part that...
Yeah, okay. I don't want to get into that. Yeah, I mean, obviously they're not real winners. If Hirens is one, and the other one is called the Ultimate Boot CD. Both of them have ways to securely, thoroughly erase that hard drive.
Okay. Oh, wonderful. Thank you so much.
Sure. Ultimate Boots. So what you're going to do is find a friend, download Hirons or the Ultimate Boot CD software. Both are free. Make a USB drive that you boot up. Bring it over to the old computer. Boot up into it. And then run the eraser tool. And just clobber that hard drive. And nothing will be left.
Okay. Thank you so much.
You're welcome. I'm sorry that that stinks.
It's, you know, it's... stuff happens, I guess, but thank you so much.
All right. You're welcome.
You made my day.
Good. I'm glad you, I'm glad I was here for you. I'm glad we could talk, Julie.
I am too. You're, thank you so much.
You're going to get a better job. How's your ankle? Is it okay?
Yeah, it's getting better.
Good.
It's getting better.
You're going to get a, you're going to get a better job. Somebody's saying, and they're right. If these guys really lock down the computer, you may not be able to erase everything, but,
okay.
Cause it's possible to, for instance, block the USB port. So that you can't boot up.
I happen to know mine is open.
Good.
Yeah.
You're good.
Yeah, so it's all good. Thank you so much.
Thanks. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. I'm so tired of being 8888. Ask Leo. What I ended up telling Julie to do. This is actually something you might, all of you might think about doing, is downloading a tool. There's a couple of them. One's called Hirons, H-I-R-E-N-S, boot disc, and the other's called the Ultimate Boot CD. And what these are tools you download and you make a bootable USB key out of. And that's actually a good thing for everybody to have because they have all sorts of things, virus scanners and, you know, just things that can help you solve a problem with the computer. Oftentimes when the computer is messed up, you can't boot into it. You want an external operating system. So having that around is a really handy thing to have. And that would, she could use either the Ultimate Boot CD or Hirons. We'll put both of those, links to both of those in the show notes to fully erase that drive. As long as the boss didn't lock down the USB port. Sounds like the boss is paranoid. They didn't let her install any software. Man, that's... John in Fallbrook, California is next. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Hi, John. Hi, John.
Good afternoon, Leo. How are you?
Very well. How are you?
I'm good, thanks. Thanks for taking my call.
Thank you for calling.
I love your program.
Thank you.
My question is, I am interested in getting internet down to my electric-operated security gate, which is a couple hundred feet from my house. And my internet or my Wi-Fi is a mobile hotspot by AT&T. I don't have any landlines into the house. And even if I did, they wouldn't provide internet on them. So,
yeah. So, normally Wi-Fi goes about 150 feet and that AT&T Wi-Fi doesn't even go that far.
No.
Yeah. So you're really to get Wi-Fi out to the gate. And you know that the gate has the capability of being opened that way, right?
Yeah, it does. I checked with the manufacturer. It's got a learning mode. If you sync it so it accesses the Wi-Fi. And then they have an app that I put on my phone that I can
nice.
Open the gate.
So
but also, I would like to get a camera doorbell down there so
sure.
people want to get in
sure.
and I'm not home or... And I was thinking power line Wi-Fi, but the brief investigation I did seemed to indicate I needed to use a cable to connect the two.
Actually, so you have, of course, you have power out there. Do you have a plug out there?
I do. That, yeah.
Okay, that might be the best way to do it. So the way power line uses the wires that are already there. When you built that gate, they had to put electricity out there. And right. that you can actually double up on that power, put data on top of it. It's not super fast, but it's more than fast enough to do that. Camera might be a little challenging, but maybe not. So power line networking has gotten a lot better than it used to be. It is probably about half the speed of an Ethernet cable, more than enough to control the gate and probably enough to use a doorbell and a camera. And that would be the easiest way to do it. So what you do is, and I recommend a company called TP-Link. They're very affordable.
But I can't plug into my portable hotspot. It doesn't have a Ethernet or a USB.
Oh, I see what you're saying.
Yeah.
Well, they make them that'll pick up the Wi-Fi connection from that hotspot.
Oh, and that's exactly what I was hoping to hear.
Yeah. TP-Link. TP-LINK.
Uh-huh.
And I'm pretty sure, let me just look, but I'm pretty sure that, so I've used their power line stuff. I like it. It works very well. The idea is you're going to have two adapters, one at the gate end, one at your house end. The one at the house end, you're right, in most cases would be connected to your cable modem via an Ethernet port. But I'm pretty sure, I'm going to look, that they have power line that will just pick up the Wi-Fi, that you basically use it as a Wi-Fi range extender.
And if they didn't, would there be a dongle I could plug in?
Yeah, but it looks like they do. I'm looking at it right now. It will. It's the AC1750 Wi-Fi range extender.
Oh, okay.
And you plug it in. So you're gonna now. The only caveat on power line networking is there can't be an interruption between the plug next to the plug at the gate and the plug where the Wi-Fi is. You know, you can't have a junction box or a fuse box or anything like that.
No, I do have an off-on switch.
No, that's okay, but you need a straight shoot.
Okay.
So as long as there's nothing in there that will interrupt it, like a fuse box, an on-off switch is not. I mean, you'll have to leave it on, obviously.
Yeah.
But as long as the power's on the same circuit, not interrupted by a fuse box, yeah. And then they're not expensive. Take a look at the TP-Link, and it'll pick. So what it does is one is a Wi-Fi access point that picks up the Wi-Fi from your AT&T device, and then it sends it down the power line to the other end at the gate, and that gate uses the Wi-Fi at the other end. So it's a way of extending Wi-Fi. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. 8888 Ask Leo. About a half an hour left in the show. That's plenty of time to take your call. I'll start with Joe in Tampa, Florida. Hi, Joe.
Hey, good afternoon, Leo.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Hey, I wanted to say thanks on the lead you gave me on the Motorola G5 a few weeks ago.
Did you get one?
The phone. Oh, God, it's beautiful as far as
Oh, nice. Oh, that makes me happy. I'm glad.
Yeah, it's faster than I ever expected. I've got one problem, and that's probably because of the later software that's running on the phone. I'm running 7.0.
Yeah.
And the problem I'm having is that if there is an app that's installed on the SD card, when I go to reboot the phone, restart it, I lose my favorite, or if I go up to the home screen, I normally lose the icon to the favorite. I put it on the home screen, respectfully.
It disappears?
Yes, sir.
Huh. Yeah, I mean,
coming strictly from that, from the fact that those applications are located on the
SD card. Yeah, it definitely is related to that. So it's always a challenge. All phones have trouble with SD cards. That's why a lot of phones these days don't have them, because it's difficult for the operating system. You know, the card is not – the operating system can't be sure the card's there. It has to get mounted and so forth. Sure. And so, for instance, if the application you're using has desktop widgets – and maybe that's the issue. Maybe it's not icons, it's widgets. They won't work if you're on the SD card. You have to be on the main memory.
Okay.
So that's just the way it is with Android. There really isn't a good fix for that. But usually the operating system won't let you move the app to the SD card. It'll say, no, you can't because it has widgets. Are they widgets or are they icons?
As far as I know, it's the icons. If okay. I go back and reinstall the, go into the, you know, flip up and go to the, where the app, where all the apps are located, I can bring it back.
You just drag it, you drag it out of the application drawer onto the desktop?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's an icon.
And it's fine.
And then it'll stay there until you reboot and it goes away.
Yes, sir.
Yeah, I think it is related. You nailed it. It's related to the fact that the app is installed on the SD card. Some apps don't do well on the SD card. That's just the way it is. You can try, and I mean, if you want to try another launcher, one of the things that's great about Android is you don't have to use the stock launcher. You're using Google's launcher, the Pixel launcher. Maybe you're using a Motorola launcher. But they're third-party launchers. I like Action Launcher. These are Action Launcher. You download them just like apps, but you'll change the default application in the app settings. You'll change it to whichever launcher you want to use. There's also one called Nova Launcher. You can try both of them free. They do have paid versions, but the free versions are very capable. And just see if you get the same behavior in those launchers. It might be a bug in the Motorola launcher. But that's one of the things I love about Android is you can use third-party launchers. And actually, I have. You can also try. I'm pretty sure that G5 is using the Motorola launcher. Google has its own launcher called the Pixel launcher. You could try that as well. It might not have the same issue.
All right. Well, I'll go take a look then. That's good. Yeah, you give me some information.
Yeah, it's no harm to install them and see if you like it. It's just like another application. And if you don't like it, you don't install it.
Sounds like a plan, sir. Thank you very much.
Give it a try.
My pleasure.
I'm glad you like that phone. Yeah, very affordable phone. Motorola makes some nice handsets. They were a Google company, remember? And Google bought them. Couldn't figure out what to do with them. Sold them to Lenovo. And at least for a while, the team that made the Moto phones was in Chicago, not in China. I think they've shut down the Chicago offices now. And I think they have moved it out to China, which means those phones may not continue to be so great. I don't know. But when it was the team in Chicago that was with Motorola, then Google, then Lenovo, those guys were good. They made good stuff. And I think that phone maintained its quality for a long time. I know the G5's great. It uses the Now Launcher. Okay. So out of sync, the Now Launcher is telling me in the chat room, the Now Launcher is the old Google launcher. Google's replaced that with a Pixel launcher. So you can go to the Google Play Store and search for, just if you search for launchers, you'll see many choices. The Pixel launcher is the official launcher from Google for Android 8. Probably it'll work on your Android 7. If it doesn't, then try Nova or Action. I use Action Launcher. I like it a lot. I'm actually very happy with the new Google launcher. When I'm trying out the next generation of Android, Android P, they call it. They haven't yet given it a dessert name. It's great. Very stable. It's a public beta that Google put out at Google I.O. a couple of weeks ago. And it uses the Pixel launcher. And I actually like it a lot. But these third-party launchers, the alternative launchers, often have many additional features. They're highly customizable. And so a lot of, real Android enthusiasts will choose a third-party launcher instead of the one that came with the phone. Paul on the line from La Jolla, California. Hi, Paul.
Hi, Rob. My question is to you, a TV converter box goes to cable internet box. What's the difference? You get better quality if you go to a TV converter box. I know you're going to get less channels.
Yeah, I'm not sure what the difference, what GTE says the difference is between So typically a converter box is the set-top box that comes with your cable that takes whatever data is coming in over the copper cable and turns it into something your TV can understand. And you use the converter box to switch channels and all of that. It's the cable box. The internet box is a little different. The internet box may give you TV capabilities. A lot of times they combine a converter box and a cable modem. That's what you need for the internet is a cable modem. So I'm suspecting that what you have is there's standalone converter box, which is just for TV, and then a hybrid box, which mixes the converter box in with the internet access. And yeah, you would get more channels because you'd get all the internet channels on there, but you'd have to pay for internet service to use it.
Oh, I see. Okay, well, thank you very much.
My pleasure. Yeah, they don't really explain anything, do they? The cable companies. They just come and they give you the stuff. And here you go. Good luck. Natchitoches, Louisiana. Tommy, am I saying it right? Natchitoches?
Yeah, you're close. It's Natchitoches.
Natchitoches. Natchitoches?
Yes, sir.
Oh, boy. I've been saying it wrong all my life. Natchitoches.
Well, there's a twin sister city. It's called Natchitoches.
Oh.
Texas.
You're not Natchitoches, Texas. You're Natchitoches, Louisiana.
Correct.
Is it spelled the same?
No. Okay. Nowhere near it.
Okay, so I was confusing you with Nacogdoches, Texas.
It's all good.
Nacogdoches, Louisiana. Tommy, what can I do for you?
All right, I have a small server. I have a C drive and a D drive. D drive's mostly the data, whether shared folders, shared files. And I have an unallocated space. And if you go to disk management, the way it's laid out, you have the C drive, D drive, unallocated space.
How big is that unallocated space?
A little over a terabyte.
Oh! Yeah, it's not unusual to have some unallocated space just because of drive geometry, but it shouldn't be more than a few hundred megabytes at most. If it's a terabyte, yeah, you want it.
Correct. Now, my C drive, throughout the years, is starting to get full, and I need to extend it. But the only way to extend it is the unallocated space is going to be to the right of the C drive.
Yeah, hang on a bit. I got to take a break because we're coming up against the ad. But I can help you. Okay. I can help you do this. This kind of partition management can always be tricky. Usually, you want to use a third party tool rather than the Windows tool. But we'll talk some more here. Hold on a sec, Leo Laporte, the tech guy. So in your layout, sorry, I had a break there, but we're still here. Nacogdoches.
C-H-E-S.
C-H-E-S. And that's pronounced Nacogdoches.
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 N-A-K-I-T-U-S-H.
Nacogdoches.
There you go.
All right. Thank you for the lesson. I'm sorry I said it wrong. I was thinking of Nacogdoches, Texas. So you've got your layout, and you have this unallocated space at the end of it. You can't. Have you tried just formatting it? It's already there. Can you format it?
I can format it. That's not a problem.
Oh, but you want it to join in with another partition. You want to merge it.
I don't know if I can extend the C drive. From what I understand,
yeah. You want to merge it over. Yeah, I understand now.
It's got to be between the C and the D for the C to extend.
Yeah. That's interesting. Okay, so you've got C, you've got D, and you've got unallocated space in that order. And what you want to do is expand C into that unallocated space.
Correct.
And because the D's in the middle, I think, I don't know. It may be that I think this is probably a limitation of the Windows Partition Manager, which is not very capable. So one thing you could do is go to EaseUS, EaseUS. They have a partition manager that's free. You can download and see if it can do it.
Okay.
It may just be a limitation of the Windows part, which is not very sophisticated. On the other hand, it may be an actual geometric limitation of the way, in other words, if it's not dynamic partitions, if it's actual, hard-coded physical partitions, it may just be a limitation. So, okay. But a third party, the best way to verify that is to use a third party because it'll be more capable anyway. And the EaseUS is free, and it should be able to do it. What it may do, and I think the chat room is saying this, is it may just do it in two steps. It may move the D over into the unallocated area and then join them together.
Right.
But so I think
that was my concern. If I move the D drive, how does that affect all the shared folders?
Doesn't matter because Windows sees it as the D drive. It doesn't. It's the drive letter is all that matters, and it won't reassign that.
Okay.
But I think that you should back up before you do this.
Oh, definitely.
I don't want you calling saying, Leo, you said it was okay and everything's gone and I don't know what to do now. Make a good backup.
I have to move to Nacogdoches if I'm
there. Bye-bye, Louisiana. Yeah, I think that I would make a good backup that you know is good and then try it. But EaseUS also has a free backup tool as well.
Okay, cool.
They have an imaging tool that's really good. Hey, it's nice to talk to you, Tommy.
Thank you, sir.
Take care. Bye-bye.
All right.
Leo Laporte, the tech guy, 8888, ask Leo, the phone number. So I ended up talking through, Tommy had a partitioning question, pretty arcane. But in general, if you want to do something complicated with your disk layout, the Windows Partition Manager, which is useful and is much more capable than it used to be. Used to be it'd erase everything before it did anything. Is still much more limited than the third-party tools. So I just sent him to a site that has a free, very capable partition manager. The site is EaseUS. We'll put the link in the show notes. EaseUS. And their partitioner will almost certainly do what Tommy needed to do, which is kind of reorganize his logical partitions on his physical hard drive, if that makes any sense. From the chat room, Marsworm is on the line. Hi, Marsworm.
Hello.
Nice to put a voice to a handle.
Love the show.
Thanks for listening. You've been in the chat room for years, and I appreciate all the contributions you make in there. Thank you.
Thanks. I'm having a problem with I'm running like a media server on my Mac Mini, and the drives that are mounted seem to disconnect after it comes up, wakes up from sleep.
Oh, darn sleep. I hate sleep. Sleep seems to confuse computers something awful, doesn't it?
Yeah.
So, in theory, nothing should change when you're sleeping. Sleep means that the RAM is refreshed. You know, it's not a very low power mode. It's just a little bit of a low power mode. It turns the screen off. The CPU slows down. But in theory, anything that's mounted before sleep should remain mounted after sleep. But it's not. Mounting is that process of making that drive appear. So Windows 10?
No, it's a Mac Mini.
Oh, you said Mac. Of course you did.
Yeah.
Is it which version of OS X is it?
Hi, Sierra.
Yeah, I'm looking. As a matter of fact, on the Google about drives unmounting after sleep. Now, this goes back to Yosemite. It was apparently a bug. Is it a USB drive or an internal drive?
They're network shares.
They're network shares.
Yeah, but one's a Synology and another's
a...
Oh. Okay. And I'm trying to... and it's Kodi. And I'm accessing the files from there to the Mac Mini. And, I can't play the media after they get disconnected.
Yeah. So a network share shows up as basically as mapped. And I do seem to remember a setting that would say reconnect. It's interesting that it's unmounting that share and then remounting it when it's, you'd have to remount. And you are able to remount it, right?
Yes, yeah. After I restart the computer, I found a fix to do that by having the drive mount,
right.
By putting it in the login items.
Right.
It's
just remounting it because you're re-logging in.
Yeah. But
so are you logging out when you go to sleep? I guess you are. Now, I guess if you turned off require password, have you tried this turning off require password after sleep?
No, it doesn't require a password. It just goes to sleep, and if I press the escape key or whatever, it'll just wake up.
You might want to look at the sometimes net. Now, I don't know how to do this on a Mac. On Windows, there's this checkbox in the driver for the network interface cards. They can sleep, and that could cause you to lose a network share. So, that's a hardware attribute. So I'm sure there's somewhere in Mac OS you can change that. I would check that out. And missing in the chat room is saying, yeah, and I seem to remember this. Keep drives mounted on Mac OS X using auto FS. This rings a bell because it was an auto remount thing. So take a look at auto FS and see if, is that available? Yeah. And you're in the chat room, Marsworm. You're probably seeing all the things I'm seeing. It looks like that program is something people use to solve this exact problem. And then there is a link. When a Mac computer is in sleep mode, it can continue sharing services such as iTunes and photo library sharing. How does it work? So there's a link to a Apple note about Wake on Demand as well. So that's a little different, but I would take a look at AutoFS. I think that this is probably was created to precisely to solve this issue. That'd be my guess. But you know what? You're in the chat room. They got a better handle on it than I do. It does sound familiar, though. Hey, it's really nice to talk to you. I'm glad to have you in the chat room, and thank you so much for your help. Marsworm is one of our Team Tech Guy folks that live in the chat room at irc.twit.tv, and as I do the show, very often come up with great solutions. So you're not just asking me when you have a question. We have a team of hardworking chatters doing their best. Hey, we've had some fun today. By the time I get back here next weekend, the General Data Protection Regulation, GDPR, will be in effect. Will be very interesting. Watch for your email box. You'll probably get, I know we all will, a flood of email from companies saying, our policies have changed because they're all nervous about GDPR. But what impact will it have? I think it's going to be kind of like Y2K. Remember why we were all worried that the whole world would come to an end? I was on call. I worked at a cable channel called Tech TV, and we were all on call in case everything went squirrely on New Year's Day 2000, the Y2K bug, nothing went wrong. And I'm suspecting that GDPR will be kind of like that. But next weekend I'll be here and we can talk a little bit about it, its implications, what you've done, and, you know, maybe by then we'll know more. It's all kind of a mystery. Thanks so much to our ABLE staff, of course, Kim Schaffer, for answering all the phones today. Thank you, Kim. Michael Cozio, our musical director, for spinning the hits, pushing the buttons, making it all happen downstream. Our network operations center, too. They never get credit. I think they deserve some credit. And thanks most of all to you for listening. I'll be back next weekend to continue our ongoing conversation about how the world is changing according to technology. I'm Leo Laporte, the Tech Guy. Have a great Geek Week. Well, that's it for the Tech Guy show for today. Thank you so much for being here. And don't forget, TWIT, T-W-I-T. It stands for This Week in Tech, and you'll find it at twit.tv, including the podcasts for this show. We talk about Windows on Windows Weekly, Macintosh on Mac Break Weekly, iPads, iPhones, Apple Watches on iOS Today, Security on Security Now. I mean, I can go on and on. And on. And of course, the big show every Sunday afternoon, This Week in Tech. You'll find it all at twit.tv. And I'll be back next week with another great Tech Guys show. Thanks for joining me. We'll see you next time.